Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering a groundbreaking study being conducted by researchers at the Kingston Health Sciences Centre Research Institute.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
For the first time ever, researchers are studying whether non-hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, the active compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, could help to treat generalized anxiety disorder. The Kingston Health Sciences Centre Research Institute is leading this first-of-its-kind Health Canada-approved Phase 2A clinical trial. The trial will be testing the daily, at-home use of microdose psilocybin to see if it can safely ease anxiety symptoms without the trip. Generalized anxiety disorder affects about 5% of Canadian adults, more than 1.6 million people. And while it's common, many existing treatments can be slow to work or cause side effects that make long-term use difficult. Principal investigator of the study, Dr. Claudio Suarez, sat down with CFRC to tell us more about this first-of-its-kind clinical trial and what it could mean for the future of anxiety treatment. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name is Claudio Suarez. I'm a psychiatrist here at Queen's University. I'm professor of psychiatry at Queen's. I'm also a clinician who sees patients in the medical and surgical floors from psychiatry. I work also in oncology and palliative care. And I do research. I'm the director of the Center for Psychedelics Health and Research at Providence Care, and also doing research on psychedelics here at KGH.
Great, thank you. And getting into our topic today, I was wondering if you could start us off by speaking to the gaps and challenges in current treatments that have kind of led to us turning to exploring these alternative methods.
For sure. So as you know, we have a lot of people suffering from depression and anxiety, like more kind of a clinical disabling anxiety, like 1 out of 6 Canadians have anxiety. And not everybody does well on medications, right? So we have psychotherapies that are quite effective for anxiety. But again, not everybody has access to psychotherapy and not everybody responded to psychotherapy. And the medications that we have are primarily antidepressants that we use for anxiety. Some patients responded well, but they can't tolerate side effects. They have, you know, weight gain or sexual dysfunction. So we're always looking for new treatments for anxiety to have another tool in our toolbox. And psychedelics are emerging as kind of promising treatments for anxiety. So that's why one of the things we're looking for is the use of a low dose or microdosing psychedelics, in this case, psilocybin for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the background and evidence so far, just where we're at with psilocybin specifically.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient of the magic mushrooms, right? So they have been used in like recreationally, but also in ritual and religious ceremonies for many, many, many years. And probably over the last 10 or 15 years, we're kind of experiencing like a renaissance in research on psychedelics. People are rediscovering psychedelics as potential medical treatments and trying to apply what we know about psychedelics for many years into the medical setting. So we see a lot of studies happening in psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, for depression, anxiety, to reduce cravings for alcohol in patients who have alcohol use disorder, and for PTSD as well. Although PTSD is more MDMA, there has been studied for that. But the psychedelics, Christina, in most studies, the predominant school of thoughts for psychedelics is to use what we call macrodoses, right? So people have a dose that induces changes in their perception of the environment, and perception of themselves. That's what we call the altered states of consciousness, or the trip. It's like people go through a hallucinogenic trip, which is it's a happy phenomenon. So there's a lot of things happening in your brain at the time that you do that. But that requires patients to come to a medical setting and use that medication and be under observation for at least 6 to 8 hours. So it's labor intensive. There are some more risks and side effects involved. The more recent school of thoughts were in parallel to that, we're looking at using psilocybins in lower doses that will not cause that whole experience of psychedelics from the hallucinogenic point of view, but will still have beneficial effects in your brain, maybe increasing neuroplasticity, maybe helping you to reduce the ruminative thoughts or the, you know, constant worrying that you have and anxiety. And they seem to work well. So there's some promising studies, but they have not been tested in a more kind of a, I would say, structural way. So that's the first study that we are aware of that's using microdosing delivered at home, to be used at home for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're talking about microdosing there and kind of getting into the nitty gritty. I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into what this means, either in practical or neurological terms, sure. As opposed to, you know, going on a full macro dose and having those experiences.
For sure. So when we talk about macrodose or higher doses of psilocybins, usually we're talking about taking at least 25 or 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which then will induce that altered states of consciousness or, you know, what recreationally people call a trip, right? And that is probably the way or the mechanism by which psilocybin works in macrodoses. So it's a boost of effects at once that cause a cascade of reactions in your brain, increase neuroplasticity, and then opens that what we call more flexibility in your cognition to deal with anxiety. And that is done in combination with psychotherapy. So the notion is that you're using the macrodose to make it easier for patients to engage in psychotherapy and make it easier for them to be more cognitively flexible, to be more psychologically open to psychotherapy. When we're using microdosing, you're usually using a much lower dose, so it's between 1 to 3 milligrams. The sweet spot that we're trying to study is around 3 milligrams because it's just below the threshold for changing your brain from the hallucinogenic point of view. So at that dose, you're using the pharmacological effects of the psilocybin. So you're not inducing the hallucinogenic trips. You're not inducing changes in your perception. It's almost like using the same pathway that we use in antidepressants, but without having the side effects of the antidepressants. So the idea here is to use psilocybin more as a medicine as opposed to a catalyst for psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm, interesting. Because I think a lot of people, think about psychedelic treatment as the experience of the trip is more so what's solving your issues or helping you work through it. But this sounds like it's more like those chemical changes in your brain, and that it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, you know, what you mentioned before, the psychedelic experience make it easier for you to do psychotherapy. This is probably the predominant classic way of thinking about psychedelics. And probably, I want to say 80 to 90% of the research on psychedelics so far has been focused on that way of delivering psychedelics. But we also know that psychedelics are neuroplastogens. So they change the brain plasticity, and they also have effects through serotonin in your brain, the same chemical that we use in antidepressants. So it's interacting with the same receptors that we use in medications, for instance, for depression and anxiety. So what we're looking at here is to benefit from, you know, slow doses or low dose of psilocybin delivered every day for a period of time, similar to what we do with other medications, but hopefully have a more enduring and less troubled from the side effect point of view that we have with antidepressants. So minimizing sexual dysfunction or weight gain or all the other side effects that sometimes are a major barrier for people to take medication for anxiety.
And getting into this clinical trial, what's that going to kind of look like and what makes it such a first in Canada?
So this is the first time that we're aware of that Health Canada has approved a study to allow us to give patients microdosing psilocybin to bring it home and take it home. So as you know, psilocybin is illegal, so you cannot or you should not go and buy psilocybin anywhere. So in order for you to do studies on psilocybin, we have to apply to a lot of the regulatory bodies, including Health Canada, to get permission to obtain the psilocybin and store the psilocybin. So that has been done for other studies as well. But this study in particular allow us to then have a protocol in which patients come and try psilocybin for the first time in our hospital. They stay here for a few hours. We make sure that they don't have any unusual responses to psilocybin. And then they can take the medication at home. So they go home with a 1 week's worth of medication, and then they can use the medication at home. We monitor that very closely. And then they come every week to be reassessed up to 4 weeks. So it's a 4-week trial. And then people who responded well can stay for another 4 weeks when we then randomize them to be either on placebo or to remain on psilocybin. So that we're going to be looking at if they have any withdrawal symptoms or rebound anxiety after using for 4 weeks. So the total study is 8 weeks, but the first 4 weeks, everybody knows you're taking medication. And then the next 4 weeks, we split them between placebo and medication.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what kind of outcomes are you measuring?
Yeah, so this is a phase two trial. So clinical trials have different phases. So phase one usually is what we're looking at if the new medication is toxic or trying to find the right spot, so to speak, on the dosing. So that's how we end up with a 3-milligram dosing for this study. So this is a phase two trial. Phase two trials are usually small trials, like less than 100 patients. Well, we're trying to look at primarily safety and tolerability. So we're looking at if patients have any side effects. We check their blood work to see if their, you know, kidneys are working well, their liver, their heart, to make sure that everything is okay prior to, but also make sure the medication doesn't impact their health in general. But we also collect some data on efficacy. So we look at scales for anxiety, measure their anxiety, their self-perception of anxiety, how well they are functioning at home or at work or at school. So there are a few measures that we use to look at success. And that study will inform, hopefully, a phase three trials. For phase three are larger trials, more like what we see when we're applying for new medications to Health Canada or FDA. We have to use a phase three trial. So these are larger trials. But this trial that we're doing will inform the next one if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask you, just as a clinician and as a scientist, what excites you about diving into this research?
Well, so when I got involved with psychedelic research probably close to 3 or 4 years ago, when Queen's decided to put together an advisory board to look at psychedelic medicine. And I came from the field on psychiatry, mood disorders, but also see patients in oncology. So I was aware of the major gaps that we have in the treatments that we have for depression, anxiety, but also PTSD and oncology. A lot of patients with late stage cancer have what we call existential distress, and that really doesn't respond well to medication. And psychedelics have emerged in the last few years as a promising option for many of those patients. But there are not a lot of clinical trials happening in Canada. And I became fascinated with some of the options. And I saw and I've seen, I did a long training in U.S., close to 1 year on psychedelic research. And I've seen both patients and participants, but also videos with dramatic changes very quickly. So I became quite fascinated by the promising effects, but also very aware that psychedelic research comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of mistrust and misinformation. So getting involved in research, but also helping to destigmatize psychedelics and find the right population that can use, it became one of the areas that I'm quite interested in. So we created a center for psychedelics at Providence Care. We opened last year, and we're doing research both at Providence Care, but also at KGH as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping this means for the future of care in this area?
So I think if we can learn when and how psychedelics can be helpful, that will inform probably in a better way how can we use psychedelics in the medical setting versus recreational, which is one of the challenges with cannabis, for instance. Right? When cannabis became legalized, the research on cannabis suffered because a lot of the medical cannabis research became very difficult to conduct studies because people just go across the street and buy what they think they're buying, right, in terms of concentration and use. So what we're trying to do is to avoid that we make some of the mistakes that we made with cannabis in general, that we understand how psychedelics can be used safely for medical purpose. So then if or when psychedelics become legalized, we can clearly differentiate what is psychedelic use for medical practice versus psychedelics for recreation.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap us up here, who can take part in this study and how can people get involved or learn more?
Yeah, so people can reach out to us. They can look at, you know, CS Research at queensu.ca, but they can also reach out to KJSC or the Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. What we're looking for this particular study are anyone ages 18 to 60. Whose primary diagnosis is anxiety. Either they were diagnosed with anxiety by their GP or their primary care or psychiatrist, or they were medicated for anxiety in the past. And they're having right now anxiety that's really affecting their ability to function, like constant worries or concerns, inability to function due to anxiety. They cannot be suffering from major depression or psychosis or alcohol use disorder. But we will screen them. We will have an assessment. And if they qualify, they can come to the study. We do a series of medical assessments to make sure they are healthy otherwise. And then they can join the study.
Once again, that was Dr. Claudio Suarez, who will be leading a first-of-its-kind study on the use of psychedelics to treat generalized anxiety disorder at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. As one of the largest mental health research trials currently underway at KHSC, the study represents an important step in advancing evidence-based innovation in psychiatric care. As Dr. Suarez mentioned, researchers are currently seeking adults living with generalized anxiety disorder to join the study. To learn more or inquire about participation, you can contact the research team by email at cs.research@queensu.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, that highlights the outstanding achievements of two local folk musicians.
Thank you, Jesse. Two Kingston artists have returned to the city as award winners following last week's presentation of the 2025 Ontario Folk Music Awards in Ottawa. Kingston's Al Rankin was awarded the Estelle Klein Lifetime Achievement Award for what Folk Canada said is the lifelong dedication to fostering Canadian folk music, and Savannah Shea was awarded Song of the Year for her song Best Remembered. Rankin's longtime work as a concert promoter has earned him the Estelle Klein Lifetime Achievement Award, which Folk Canada's Executive Director Rosalind Dennett says a long list of artists have said his support goes beyond simply putting on a show. While Rankin is being recognized for his longtime work with the music industry, Savannah Shea represents the current generation of working artists and said that this year was her first experience with the Folk Music Awards, and one she wouldn't have been a part of if not urged to apply by the city's music officer, Moira DeMorest. Shea said it wasn't in her plans before that, but she was happy to be there taking advantage of what the conference had to offer and meeting other musicians on hand. I don't think I would have gone if I hadn't got the nomination because it just wasn't on my radar, Shea said. 2025 is the 39th anniversary of the Folk Music Ontario Conference, with Folk Music Canada and Folk Music Ontario merging officially this year. The awards were focused just on Ontario folk music creators and industry members, but Folk Music Canada also brought in people across the country to take part in the conference. Dennett said the hope of these awards is to get more attention on hardworking songwriters and workers in the music industry, and ultimately to help make the industry a more viable place to work in. We want to grow a working middle class of artists and music industry professionals, Dennett said. And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, with a story covering Greater Napanee's purchase of a $2 million fire truck.
Thank you, Dinah. Greater Napanee's Fire Department will replace its 22-year-old aerial ladder truck after council approved a $2 million purchase, citing reliability issues, rising maintenance costs, and outdated safety features. In a report presented at the regular meeting of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee on Tuesday, October 14th, Fire Chief Sean Armstrong recommended the non-competitive purchase of a 103-foot KME-branded aerial ladder apparatus from Dependable Emergency Vehicles out of Brampton, with delivery expected in January 2026. After discussing the feasibility and timing, Council agreed the purchase was necessary and financially advantageous. According to Armstrong, the town's current aerial truck, known as Ladder 811, has been in service well beyond its recommended 15-year frontline and 5-year reserve lifespan. Industry standards no longer recognize aerials older than 20 years, which can affect the municipality's fire protection ratings and, in turn, its emergency response and insurance. The aging vehicle has also become increasingly expensive to maintain. According to the report, records show repair costs exceeding $11,000 in 2024 and $12,000 so far in 2025, with over 70 days of downtime. Parts are difficult to source, and some of the truck's safety systems no longer meet current standards for seatbelts, lighting, and ladder mechanisms. Armstrong warned that deferring replacement could ultimately cost taxpayers more money for the unit itself and a much longer delivery wait time. In fact, the report estimates a total savings of about $926,000 if the town proceeds with the purchase this year. If approved, the municipality could make a down payment of $619,519 in 2025 and finance the remaining balance over a 10-year period. The current aerial ladder, purchased in 2003, is expected to have a trade-in value of $100,000 to $150,000. The fire chief explained that similar aerial trucks now cost $2.7 to $3 million with 3 to 4 year wait times, whereas this purchase saves about $700,000 and ensures delivery by January 2026. Refurbishment of the old ladder truck was explored, Chief Administrative Officer Matthew Grant noted, but it would not meet insurance or certification standards, meaning it would not count toward Napanee's superior fire protection rating, a factor that can influence insurance premiums and fire response capacity. Council widely agreed that the 22-year-old ladder truck is well past its useful life. The motion to approve the $2.085 million single-source purchase passed unanimously. The new truck is expected to arrive in January, increasing fire response capabilities across Greater Napanee.
And thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a report discussing the potential use of strong mayor powers to address housing shortages in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Earlier this year, Loyalist Township was named one of 169 Ontario municipalities to receive strong mayor powers. Ontario's Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing made a presentation to Loyalist Township Council this week with a focus on how these powers can help the province reach its goal of increasing housing supply. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend voiced his concerns about the focus of the presentation.
I never think it's appropriate to score political points by asking pointed questions to public servants. But I will just note that consistently in the last several years, housing starts are down in Ontario. So the evidence that these strong mayor powers are advancing that goal of increasing housing supply is certainly suspect. And this is fairly complex. But one simple thing municipalities have said consistently that will help build more housing is to fund municipal infrastructure to support that housing.
The province originally introduced strong mayor powers in 2022 for the cities of Ottawa and Toronto. Through 2023, 44 additional municipalities received these powers, and as of May 1st this year, 216 of Ontario's 414 single and lower tier municipalities now have this legislation. The presentation was part of a series of outreach sessions the province is doing for municipalities who are new to the strong mayor powers. It included an overview of what strong mayor powers are, as well as references to other municipalities and how they're implementing the powers. Mayor Jim Hagedorn spoke about the work of staff as they move forward on the matter.
Still, as we're proceeding through this, the new strong mayor power, I keep coming up with more questions. And fortunately, so far, staff have always been able to do some research and we've been able to work to figure them out. But It'll take a little while before all the municipalities, I'm sure, come to full terms with what it is.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Over to the local journalism initiative reporter for CFW and Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about a significant funding boost for hospice care in Northumberland County.
As county mayors examine where to put a warming hub for homeless people this winter, a staff report lays out several options with two outside of Coburg. The report presented and debated Wednesday by the mayor states that the paramedic facility on William Street in Coburg, the Ontario Agri-Food Venture Center in Colburn, and the Fenella Hall are potential possibilities. The two rural options would require daily transportation services. Integrated Homelessness and Addiction Response Center Director Jordan Stevenson presented to County Council Wednesday, saying none of the options will address the real problem of addictions and homelessness. He says busing people out of Coburg could present challenges in the event of a medical emergency or physical altercation or potentially people using substances.
It's a scary component. What happens if there's a crisis on the way? Are they, again, like I mentioned, are they going to be kicked off the bus? If there's a violent incident, or we get into things like transporting narcotics.
Michelle Day, who lives in Fenella, presented second. Her concerns are that Fenella is too small of a community, adding it has few stores. She predicts the police response to an emergency will be slowed due to Fenella's distance from Coburg.
There's a few stores up here. There's a lot of seniors that live around the Fenella Hall, and it's not going to be good. To get the police or the OPP to come for any situation, it takes a long time. So there's going to be a lot of things that's going to happen. Very little stores, one store really that you can get major groceries. There's going to be a lot of robbery, a lot of theft.
The county spends approximately $8 million a year on homelessness programs, much of that subsidized. The warming room at 310 Division Street in Coburg closed July 4th with the remodeling of services at the shelter. The county put out an expression of interest for a warming hub, stipulating that if it were in Coburg, it would be located on county property. While Coburg residents and businesses have expressed frustration with the situation of the shelter in the downtown core, stigmatization of homelessness is a concern. Cramie Township Mayor Mandy Martin cautioned that some people who are homeless are struggling to find accommodation but are not addicted. Coburg Mayor Lucas Cleveland countered, saying there are programs already in place to assist people wanting help. Trent Hills Mayor Bob Crate expressed annoyance, questioning how much money is being spent on people who are not ready to improve their lives.
We seem to be spending an inordinate amount of time and money for very few people that really don't want our help. And I'm getting to the point where I would like to help those that would like help and provide whatever services they need, but I'm getting frustrated by the fact that we're here dealing with, I don't know, is it five people that would be involved in this situation? And
Crate added, there comes a time in life when people need to take responsibility for themselves. Council did go into closed session to discuss the warming room and other confidential matters, but when resumed in open session, voted to defer the warming room report to an emergency meeting. A date has not been set to resume those discussions. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, October 23rd, another rainy day here in the city of Kingston. 84% chance of precipitation, feeling closer to 8 degrees, although the daytime high is listed as 11, dropping down to 5 degrees overnight. Friday, October 24th, mix of sun and cloud, another 11-degree day, still going to feel a little colder than average, right around 8 degrees, dropping down to 4 overnight. We're going to have a cool day on Saturday, October 25th for the Queens versus McMaster playoff football game, daytime high of just 9 degrees, feeling closer to 4 overnight. Sunday, October 26th, another rainy day here in the city of Kingston, 57% chance of precipitation, daytime high of 10, overnight low of 3, and then starting off next week, Monday, October 27th, 11 degrees is your high with a 60% chance of precipitation, dropping down to a chilly 2 degrees overnight.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.